This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Do you have what it takes to climb up Mount Everest? Well, imagine successfully climbing 9 times. Coming up, we hear my interview with West Hartford resident Lhakpa Sherpa, the only woman in the world to hold this record. But first, one of the latest stories from National Geographic magazine focuses on a topic we've talked about on the show, the rising maternal death rate in America. Throughout the latest Nat Geo story are photographs by award-winning photojournalist and former Where We Live guest, Lindsay Addario. For more than 2 decades, Addario has captured images from conflicts around the world. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She's the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant and was awarded a Pulitzer for international reporting. Lindsay's also a Connecticut native, and she's released a new book called Of Love and War. We spoke to her from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Lindsay, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
I was thinking, as I look through your book and from being a journalist for many years, when we see photographs from conflict zones, whether it's in a newspaper or a magazine, we don't know very much about the person behind the lens. Instead, we're focusing on the image before us. And I was thinking about how dangerous your job is. And in the book, you include details of things that have happened to you while covering stories in places like Iraq and Libya, including in 2011 when you and 3 other journalists were held by the Libyan army. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, what happened in Libya, we were covering the popular uprising in 2011, and I was working with Tyler Hicks, Anthony Shadid, and Steve Farrell for the New York Times. And we were working the front line, and me and Tyler had been working on the front line for about 2 weeks at that point. And I was getting ready to head back east to Benghazi, which was sort of a safer area further away from the front line. And we were in the town of Ajdabiya, and Gaddafi's troops were coming closer and closer. So they were pushing in from the west. And we were working sort of alongside the rebels. We were covering the war from the perspective of the rebels. And as Gaddafi's troops pushed in closer, we knew that there was a risk that they might overrun the city that we were in. And we had to sort of make a decision as to how long to stay. And as journalists, and of course as photographers, we always want to stay as long as we possibly can because we want the freshest photos, we want pictures of combat, and we want pictures of wounded. So we got a call that Gaddafi's troops were in the city. Our driver, Mohammed, got a call from his brother who was working with the BBC. And we decided to stay a bit longer to keep trying to cover the fighting. And by the time we made a decision to pull out east toward Benghazi, we ran directly into one of Gaddafi's checkpoints. And they were incredibly hostile because Gaddafi had made many announcements saying, if you see journalists, they're all spies, you should kill them. We had anyone covering the popular uprising in Libya had entered illegally from Egypt because it was the only way to cover the war. Gaddafi didn't want journalists in the east covering the fighting. So we were taken, and we were put face down in the dirt, had guns put to our head. They were about to execute us. Each one had a gun put to our heads. And they decided not to. They said, we can't shoot them. We're American. The commander said, we can't shoot them. They're American. And so instead, they tied us up, blindfolded us, placed us in vehicles on the front line, and held us there for hours as bombs and bullets rained around us. They beat us. They threatened us with execution. And this went on over the course of 6 days. We were put in prison. We couldn't speak to one another except for one night when we were in a prison cell together alone. But we could hear each other getting beaten and groped, but we couldn't speak. So it was terrifying.
Did you have faith that you would be able to go home again?
You know, the thing about being kidnapped is you don't know and you don't have any control. And I think that is the scariest part. I mean, I think any one of us can endure, you know, getting punched, getting threats or whatever you have to endure because the human spirit goes into this sort of survival mode. But I think the scary thing is the unknown. So for me, that's sort of what I was consumed with, not knowing if I would survive, if I might be raped. There were, you know, there are a lot of unknowns in that situation.
In your new book of Love and War, we see photographs from that time that you spent in Libya. How did you decide to include the photographs that you did? Because you've been doing this now for more than 20 years, taking thousands of photographs. I'm just curious if you could walk us through that process.
Sure. I mean, I think first I'll answer to the fact that when we were taken in Libya, everything we owned was stolen. We had all the photographs I had taken, my computer, our bags, my shoes off my feet. And so a few days before that happened, I had a sort of premonition that something might happen. And I actually gave a hard drive of all of my work from Libya to that date to a colleague, Brian Denton. And I said, if we get taken or if something happens to me, can you please make sure my photos survive? And so that's the only reason why I still have that body of work from Libya. I had, you know, whatever I filed to the New York Times while I was on assignment, but I had a more comprehensive body of work because I had given a hard drive off a few days before. When I was, when I finally made the decision to do a book of photography, it was really difficult because I do have millions of photographs. I've been photographing for 23 years all over the world, and I don't consider myself the best editor of my own work. So I started sort of making these folders of not only countries that I've worked in, but some of the bodies of work that have sat with me over time. And I made some phone calls and talked to some colleagues about book designers and book editors, because often a photographer will pair up with someone who can help sort of usher them through the process of how to put a photo book together. And I was given the name of Stuart Smith, who is based in London. He's done many, many books for many years. And I went to see him. And we established a rapport, and I sort of just dumped thousands of pictures onto him and said, okay, let's see what you think. Let's see what, you know, what your vision is. And he was familiar with my work, but I think once they started combing through the pictures, I kept going back every few weeks over the course of about a year. And we finally sort of honed it down to pretty much what you see in the book, more or less.
And it, readers will see that you take us through the time you spent in Afghanistan and in Iraq during the war, but also in several countries, African countries. And just again, I'm curious, as you look through this body of work, right? You said millions of photographs. Do you see how you were able to take a picture? Did that change over the years? How did you view these pictures today? Did you still see them as good photographs?
Yeah. So no. I mean, look, my first sort of trip that was into a dangerous place was to Afghanistan under the Taliban. And I made three trips to Afghanistan before September 11th. And, you know, frankly, I was 27 years old. I was not a very good photographer. I didn't really have the tools to know how to photograph in a place where photography was illegal. So how to sneak photos and work under pressure. And half my pictures were out of focus. Some are, you know, I had them developed. I was shooting film at the time. I had them developed in Pakistan, and they completely scratched all my negatives, and sometimes the fixer wasn't working, which means so my negatives were half exposed. And so, you know, I would do it very differently if I could go in back into that situation now with the experience and the knowledge I have as a photographer.
People can choose many careers. How did you get into becoming a photojournalist? And walk us through what it was like to start your career, because you mentioned, I think, the first time that you were living abroad was in India and you didn't have much money.
No. I was raised in Westport, Connecticut, and I was raised in a family of hairdressers, essentially. And so it was a very, very creative household, one that really fostered creativity and expression. And, you know, so it was very artistic and a lot of fun. And so my parents never put any sort of conditions on me or my sisters and said, you must do this, or you must go to college, and you must become this. And they just said, follow your dreams and follow your heart, and you'll be successful. And so for me, when I became interested in photography, I wasn't familiar with photojournalism. I didn't understand that you could tell stories with photographs and cover these international relations and politics with photography. So I moved to Argentina right after college. I was 21 years old, and I moved there to learn Spanish. And it was really there that I became aware of pictures in the newspaper and how you can tell stories with pictures. And so I started photographing there and managed to sort of talk my way into a job at the Buenos Aires Herald there. And then I went back to the U.S. and started making a name for myself in New York as a freelance photographer. I was freelancing for the Associated Press. And I never had any money. I was dirt poor. I always had about, if I was lucky, I had about $12 in the bank. And I was always struggling to buy cameras. And meanwhile, my sisters were leading a more conventional life and getting married, falling in love and getting married. And my father and his partner, Bruce, would help. They would pay for the wedding. And so I went to my father and Bruce with a proposal. And I said, I'm in my 20s and I have no interest in getting married right now. And would you advance me my wedding money as if I was getting married now so I can buy my first cameras? And then by the time I care about marriage, I won't need your help. So that's how I got my first cameras.
When you think about trying to get access when you're oftentimes photographing very uncomfortable situations, how do you do it? How do you get them to trust you?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest part of being a photojournalist is being able to get the people that I'm photographing to open up to me, to trust me, to be authentic. A lot of that, for me personally, I am very honest myself. I go in, I don't have sort of my cameras out. I go in, I sit down, I introduce myself, I talk to whoever it is that I'm going to photograph, and, you know, I explain why I think it's important to tell their story and ask if they want to share their story. You know, I mean, they have a sovereign right to say no. And many people say no to me. But I think the people who choose to speak with journalists and to open up and to let me photograph them are people who understand that the effectiveness of photography and the effectiveness of getting their stories out, because they can help other people too.
When you think about being a woman, how did that impact your access to different countries because you weren't a man? I was thinking when I was looking at those pictures when you were photographing in Afghanistan under Taliban rule, how did they interact with you? And at times, was it dangerous?
So, yeah, I mean, everyone always asks me about my gender. And for me, being a woman has always been a huge advantage. I have been able to access women in countries that are segregated by gender. And so as a foreign woman, I have access to the women, but I also have access to the men because they sort of they allow me into most spaces. And so it's always been a great asset. And under the Taliban, it was even more so because photography was illegal, so I could go into the women's hospital, for example, and the Taliban wouldn't come inside. So the women didn't mind if I took their picture, and they wanted to show how devastating the conditions were there, how they had no medicine, how they had very few doctors and nurses. And so they were very happy to have someone there telling their story. And so they allowed me to photograph, and the Taliban couldn't even come inside.
I mentioned earlier what happened to you in Libya, but you'd also were kidnapped when you were covering a story in Iraq during the war. And as a woman, when we think about safety, was that something that you worried about often?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I still worry about. I just returned from Yemen, and I was also in northern Nigeria over the last 2 months. And so I think I'm constantly thinking about my security and how to do these stories and do them, you know, there's always a calculated risk involved, but to do them in a way where I can come back alive. I think I've been kidnapped twice, but I think, you know, anyone who does this job understands that these are some of the risks, and, you know, we are all willing to take them because we believe in journalism, we believe in the power of photojournalism, and also the importance of being there to bear witness, to tell these stories, to create a set of documents that's factual. I think it's exponentially important now where we have a president that talks about fake news a lot. I think we need to stand up and say, you know, journalism is a fundamental right and we are a society built on free press.
Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist who's covered stories for the New York Times. I spoke with her before the Times published its series on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen that included gut-wrenching images of children who were starving to death. I asked her how photojournalists respond to criticism that images capturing suffering and death are sensational.
There are millions of Yemeni children, for example, on the brink of famine. And so, you know, yes, they're sensational images, but we're not creating that sensation. We're not creating that situation. We as photographers are going in to document the situation there because no one can get in. Very few photographers and journalists can get in. And that is sadly the reality. So it's not sensationalizing the reality. It is the reality. And so aid workers, governments, you know, we American citizens, our tax dollars are going to help support and perpetuate the war in Yemen. Now, that, in my opinion, is something we should be ashamed of. And so I think, you know, when perhaps Americans see these images of children who are starving, and this is all a result of the ongoing war in Yemen. So it's sensational, but it's the reality. And so the people, when I walk into a hospital, for example, and see children who are skin and bones, and their mothers are sort of thrusting their children toward me and saying, you know, show the world my child, because they can't do anything else. And they only can hope that the international community will come in and act. And so I think, you know, it's not sensationalizing, it's more documenting what is actually there.
Lindsay, how do you respond to, along that question, that your pictures are more of a westernized view, that you're the outsider looking in on this photograph and may not be able to capture exactly what's happening to that person?
Of course. I mean, I can't change where I'm from. I am a foreigner. I am a Westerner. I do go into countries that are not my own. And so I think in an ideal world, we would have local people photographing their own wars. But that's not always possible because, for example, a person photographing in his or her own country might be thrown in prison for trying to express dissent against the government. You know, a lot of these countries are authoritarian. Journalists are routinely disappeared, kidnapped, threatened, and killed. And so I think that foreigners have a bit more of a safety net, and particularly Americans, because until this point, we've had governments who stand up for journalism and journalists and American citizens around the world. And so I think, you know, I go in, I try to be as empathetic and understanding and do my homework about the culture and the war or whatever is happening. But at the end of the day, I can't change where I've come from.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. I'm talking with Lindsay Addario, an award-winning photojournalist. She's a Connecticut native whose work has appeared in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. Lindsay has a new book out called Of Love and War, which includes pictures from her time covering war and conflict around the world for more than two decades. After the break, we'll continue our conversation. And you can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist who grew up in Westport, Connecticut. Her career spans more than two decades and has taken her around the world, from Afghanistan to sub-Saharan Africa and beyond. Her first photo book came out recently. It's called Of Love and War. The pictures provide a glimpse into her career, but the book also includes personal letters and interviews that gives context to the people she's met and the stories she's covered. I wanted to ask you, Lindsay, to talk about how you cope with some of the trauma that you're seeing every day, because we are human and it's hard. Sometimes journalists are told to keep your emotions at bay. But when you, again, are in these very delicate moments, and there's an anecdote of you share a letter you wrote to your mother after seeing children in a cancer ward in Baghdad and how that impacted you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really subscribe to the journalists need to be hardened and keep their emotions at bay and be stoic. And that's not me. I mean, I couldn't do this job if I was that type of person. You know, I care about everyone I photograph. I'm constantly plagued and tortured by the fact that I was born into a life of relative privilege and so many people around the world were not. And so for me, I go into situations, I talk to people, I sometimes cry with them, sometimes I cry while I'm photographing. You know, I think this is all part of this job and having done this work for over 20 years. So I think what I wanted to do with this book is include some of that narrative, include some of the things that I was feeling when taking these pictures, the frustration, the sadness, the devastation, the unknown, there's one letter that I write that says, you know, I almost died today and every day I feel like I'm going to die, you know, and I think that was a reality at that point. And many people, when they look at the New York Times, when they read the New York Times Magazine or Time, they don't understand that there is an actual person taking those pictures, risking their lives and getting very emotional.
Lindsay, what made you keep doing your job time and time again, despite, you know, feeling these emotions, despite surviving several times over when, you know, you could have easily been killed when you were covering the wars or in delicate situations?
Look, I believe in journalism. I believe that the world has a right and they have a responsibility to know what's happening around the world, especially if there are injustices against people and women and, you know, children. There are civilian casualties that take place in these wars. There are people starving. We need to know, you know, just because we live in a comfortable home in America where we don't have fighting on our doorstep, we can do something with our power as a nation. Around the world, people have looked to America to be sort of the police of the world, to go in when there's a genocide happening, when there's something happening, they turn to America to intervene. And we have to be principled and have integrity. And I think that journalists and journalism hold people accountable. And so it's very important to me, this work.
It seems as you follow the work that you've done through the years, Lindsay, you gravitate towards issues that women encounter in other parts of the world, including in Sierra Leone. Can I ask you to describe, there's a series of three photographs where you are following women who are delivering and focusing in on the fact that there is a high maternal mortality rate in a place like Sierra Leone. The story of this 18-year-old who just delivered twins was especially heartbreaking.
Yeah. So in 2009, when I won the MacArthur Fellowship, I wanted to do something more long term. I wanted to do something, a series of pictures or stories where I wasn't necessarily getting them assigned to me from a publication. So I finally had money and I wanted to send myself and do these stories. So I started researching and I learned that over 500,000 women a year were dying in childbirth for almost completely preventable causes. So 98% of those deaths were preventable. And so I started looking into it, and Sierra Leone was one of the countries with the highest rate of maternal mortality. And so I went there. And I think at that time, there were about three OBGYNs in the whole country. And there were very few doctors in the provinces, the remote provinces. And so I went to the Mog Baraka Government Hospital in rural Sierra Leone. And when I got there, I met Mama Cisse. She was a young woman. She actually was in school, and her father pulled her out of school to get married as a young woman and to have children when she was about 15. And so she was pregnant with twins, and she delivered the first baby in the village, and the second baby wouldn't come out. And so her sister, who was a midwife, had thought ahead, and knowing the maternal death rate in Sierra Leone, had sent an ambulance toward their village. And to get to that ambulance, Mama Cisse had to take a canoe across a river after having just delivered a baby and with one still inside, and then take that ambulance and drive about 6 hours over bumpy roads. And so when I met her, she was exhausted. But we talked. We talked for about an hour. I asked her all about her life and her studies. And then she delivered the second baby. And I was recording video but also shooting stills, and I realized the midwives, after she delivered her baby, the midwives were all sort of talking and concentrating on trying to revive the baby, because that often happens. The baby had been inside her so long that it was almost unresponsive. So the midwives were all gathered around the baby, and I looked over, and Mama Cisse was bleeding profusely. And I said, I think she's bleeding too much. And you know, I'm not a doctor, but it just didn't look right. And they were like, no, she's fine. And they sort of mopped up the blood. And so then I went to try and find that one doctor in the province, and he was in surgery. And so I put on scrubs and I went into surgery, and I said, you know, I think there's a woman who's dying. And he sort of looked at me like I was crazy and said, you know, well, I'm busy, I'm in surgery. And so I went back and they took her blood pressure, and it was 60 over 30. And so they picked her up, and I said, well, why don't we just bring her to the doctor's, like, doorstep, essentially, so when he comes out of surgery, she's right there. And he came out and took her blood pressure, and she was dead. And so I went back 2 years later to a neighboring district in Sierra Leone, because at that point, Doctors Without Borders had told me that they had implemented an ambulance system sort of in response to the high maternal death rate, because ambulances could help get women to hospitals and to doctors, and that was one of the main reasons why women were dying in childbirth. And so with that ambulance system, they had determined that they lowered the maternal death rate by 60%, which is incredible. And so I went back and I continued doing that work. And so the other two images in that series are from 2012.
Your career is the focus of an upcoming movie. What can you tell us about it?
Well, right now the movie is slated to be directed by Ridley Scott, and Scarlett Johansson is attached to play me.
That's a pretty awesome choice.
It was optioned by Warner Brothers, so they are controlling pretty much everything. So, yeah, it's exciting.
When we think back to your upbringing in Connecticut, you have this lovely picture of your family when you were a little girl with your sisters and parents. How did they accept your career and what you've been able to accomplish?
Look, I don't think any of this would be possible without my family, because I have been so lucky. I have the most incredible family. I have supportive parents. I have my sisters. I have a great husband. I'm very lucky. And I think that what keeps me going in so many of these tough situations is the fact that I feel empowered. I feel like I come from a really solid base. I'm emotionally stable. And I'm resilient because I come from a place of stability and of love. And so I think, you know, for me, my family is a huge part of who I am and why I became the woman I am.
I should have asked you at the start of the interview. There's this beautiful picture on the cover of your new book of Love and War. How did you choose this particular photo?
So there were about five images I was contemplating to go on the cover, and the book designer Stuart and his team also came to me with some images that they thought, and ultimately we sent I think three options over to Anne Godoff, who is the head of Penguin Random House and my editor on this book, and she chose this cover on the book. It's of a rebel with the Sudanese Liberation Army, and it's a man. A lot of people think it's a woman. And we had snuck into Darfur in 2004 and walked in from neighboring Chad and hooked up with these rebels, and we drove around the desert with them for about 5 days. And every, I don't know, hour or so, there was a sandstorm, or the truck would break down, and we were stuck in the sand. And so this was in one of those moments where the truck had broken down, and the rebels were sort of just sitting around, and this is that image.
And Lindsay, with this book, I mean, who do you want to reach?
I want to reach not only photographers, but non-photographers. I want to reach people around the country, if not around the world, who maybe don't know so much about what happens outside of America, the issues that are still going on today, you know, maternal mortality. People tend to think that giving birth is just a fact of life, but it's not. It could mean death in many countries. So topics like that, refugees, people on the run, you know, we're talking about the caravan that's approaching the United States. And most people, you know, people don't really understand that the people in that caravan are human beings. They're mothers, they're children, they're people fleeing for their lives. So I want people to look at this book and have a better sense of humanity and have a better sense of what are the issues that drive people, that force people, compel them to leave their homes in the middle of the night. What does war mean? I included the wars that our country is involved in and has been involved in since September 11th, because we've had a great influence on those countries. And so I think it's important for Americans to see.
Can I ask where your next assignment's going to take you, Lindsay?
I'm not sure, actually. I just finished northern Nigeria and Yemen, so I need to go home. I haven't been home in a while.
Lindsay Addario, again, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist and author of this new book of love and war. She grew up in Connecticut in Westport, and today she joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Lindsay, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we'll meet a West Hartford resident who's the only woman to successfully climb Everest 9 times. More about Lhakpa Sherpa right after this short break. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Do you have what it takes to climb up Mount Everest? Well, imagine successfully climbing it 9 times. West Hartford resident Lhakpa Sherpa is the only woman in the world to hold this record. And Lhakpa is here with us. Lhakpa, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate inviting me here. I'm so happy.
So earlier this year, I understand that you climbed Mount Everest, as I mentioned, for the 9th time. For people who, most of us have heard of Mount Everest, but we're talking about a mountain that's 29,000 feet above sea level. What was that like to reach the ascent the 9th time?
Yes, because I'm so learning my patience in the top of the Everest. I'm born 4,000 meters in very high altitudes in my mom's house. And after I wake up, my eye, I'm a baby. My childhood, I just see this mountain around me because I never know have a toys. I never know have a cell phone, anything, electrics, my life have it. And I see this mountain, my eyes, I open. I love because we are my dad also guiding up in the mountain and many tourists. And I say, I want to follow them. Mm. My dad put this step.
Tell me more about your upbringing in Nepal. So your parents, how many siblings did you have?
I have 7 sisters and 4 brothers. Yeah, and also my both 4 brothers guiding people. Any Himalayas people come in, tourists comes, they guide service in Nepal.
So I had read that your parents were farmers, but when did your father decide to help climbers make it to the top of Everest?
My dad work hard in my mom's house, mostly mom's housewife. And my dad's one looking jobs, bring food in all the children, and give a good life in his wife. He taught it the best way. And he also, 4 brothers must send school very far away. And we are in Nepal, no school, the girl no can go to school. Anyway, my brothers, very 2 hours walk. And I must carry all the times my back, 2 brothers. One is carry, one is with me walking. And I'm look like a yellow bus in the air. You know, I carry them all the times back and forth in 4 hour. 2 hour back in school, 2 hour back in 4 hour I working. My mom's send me pick up the brother and I must go, yes.
It sounds like you were a good sister then.
Yeah, I feel like I'm look like a yellow bus.
So you were saying that the reason that your father started helping with these climbing expeditions is to help your family, including your brothers. So when did you first start helping your father in terms of helping the tourists make that climb?
Tourists comes, you know. My dad want to guide up and show them the path, guidings, hiking. And I want to go, you know, look like my dad. And my mom says no. You are the home, and you must stay home and learning the cooking, whatever women things, you must need the marriage. And I really boring, you know, I said, no, this is not my job, and I don't want it. And all my sister listen, but I'm a little bit not listen. I want to go hiking, so much beautiful hiking, hill, you know, this around me, you know, why? I want to go explore myself, you know. I don't want to stay housewife. And my mom's very worried for me. I cannot find a man because I do the man things. And she said, who marriage this girl, you know? She never no learns woman things.
This is where we live. Lakpa Sherpa's in studio with me. She's a West Hartford resident and the only woman to hold the record of climbing Mount Everest 9 times. Despite her mother's reservations, Sherpa went on to work as a porter when she was 15 years old in Nepal, working alongside her father. She would carry items for tourists from one base camp to the next.
I carry because I'm very tall, look like my dad. All my sisters are very small size, medium size. I'm a little tall, and I can't carry look like a man. Jobs, and I carry them heavy things, you know. My dad says she can carry heavy things, you know, she can go with me. But, you know, yes, my dad tests me and I can carry heavy things and I can follow his label, walking. Mm. Yeah. And he take me, he say, yes.
But it was when you were in your 20s, when you were actually able to climb yourself with other women. How did that happen? What did you have to do to get that permission to go?
One woman, Tarai, she had 3 children. And she died. She summit, but she no make it down, and she died. That time, I'm really teenagers, my age. And I said, well, I know that she died. You know, we see, you know, she died. And every woman is scared. And my everybody's, you know, really a Nepal, a Sherpa woman, Nepali woman, they really not do sport. They just want to stay home, do cooking, and give us a food and husband. And take care of the children, they do. I'm really not wanting this, and I feel I want men jobs. I like learning men jobs. What your men doing, you know? What your women doing? I want to share, you know, my experience. I want to learn how many men work hard, or how many work hard. I want to do it, but it's, I want to feel my body. I want to test them, you know, I did. And I'm so scared, you know, I really want to go climbing big mountain, small mountain. I already summit Merak Peaks, Ngawal Peaks, 6,000 meters. I never know been in school training. I just want to learn myself. Everything's myself. I learn, you know, step by step.
So how did you and this group of women, did you have to petition the Nepalese government to be allowed to climb yourselves, not as a guide, but this is something that you wanted to do?
The men's no belief. Whoa, why women climbing? This woman died, Pasan Lam was died already. Why you want to go? I really want to go, you know, I say. I want to go helping me. I say, I need the help. And I write some letters. And it give everybody's government. I really want to go. Tell, you know, some women accept, you know, some smart, educated woman. His prime minister daughters in Nepal. His name, Sushma Goyal. She's accept them. She said, yeah, she want to go. We help. You know, she did helping me. And all the Nepali women teams. I go. You know, I have a long dreams. In I summit, because I had my mind set up many, many years. I want to summit Mount Everest. I want to show them Nepali women can do it, a sport, but not have educated by this sport is learning myself. And I show them the women I can do it. You know, all women, after they really, Lakpa did. And she did again. And she did again. She not die. Everybody excited. And they follow my footsteps, and I'm very happy. Yes.
So this was a goal of yours for a long time. You said that you learned yourself. When we think about when people do different sports, they have to train for it. And Mount Everest, climbing Mount Everest, can be very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So how did you prepare?
Yes, Mount Everest is very dangerous. By luck, you know, sometimes they can kill. Sometimes Mount Everest is we cannot fight. you know, we just going. Some avalanches coming, we accept them. But I'm lucky. I feel I'm lucky. You know, they're not really. We also, Mount Everest is a God in the Mount. Chamulengmo means God in the mothers. We really respect them. All Sherpa homen respect in the Mount Everest.
Did you ever have an experience where there was an avalanche or an earthquake where you were concerned about surviving to see another day? Can you talk about that?
Yes, I am so earthquake in Nepal, 2000. Earthquake day, I'm a day in Everest base camp. I'm a game one. But all the game, base camp people die, and we stay alive. Game one people not die because game one is more dangerous, but Everest is, base camp is not dangerous. But we stay alive when game one people, the game one, two people, base camp people all die. I feel so shocked.
This was in 2015?
Yes, 2015. And I feel all the mountains coming my way. You know, I feel I'm seeing in this ice down. I feel I not see my daughters. And I so confused. 5 seconds, right there go, you know. Look like all the mountain falling different direction and noisy. And we are alive. And we come back and that day I no summit. I come back because so many people die and so many Mother Nature happens, mm-hmm. Yes.
But that didn't keep you from trying again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel I accept the Mother Nature, you know. I going back in the next times, 2016, and I summit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You were able to prove a lot of people wrong, being a woman to climb Mount Everest. You didn't die. You did it again and again and again. What is it about climbing Mount Everest? What does it mean to you to be able to achieve that?
People drinking wine all the times, never no stop. I feel like that now. I feel all the Mount Everest in my body, all the mountains. I need to go. I no go. I feel I'm sick. You know, I feel something hurt me. You know, I need to go because Mount Everest is my doctors making feel good. You know, I had a defacture makes it disappear. I feel look like changing with the ear. You know, it really make me feel good in the Everest. Yes,
I understand you have 3 children. 2 of them are daughters. How do they feel about their mother being the only woman to have summited Mount Everest 9 times? What do they say about you? Are they proud of you?
My daughters is both daughters born in Harper, Connecticut, Harper. I feel I'm a Connecticut woman right now, but my English not so good, but I feel it's a woman hear me, you know. I live in almost many years. I've been 2 children born here. My daughter is now is 16. She going Connor. One is she going Cedric's Middle School. She's 11. I'm so happy, you know. I work so hard and give this girl good educators, not look like me, you know, how they need it. I feel I'm hurt myself. I cannot read right, you know, I'm not good to speak English. And I really want these 2 girls have a great educated. I taught them my best. And I think they're doing good too, very good girl. I'm very happy. And they, of course, I go in Everest. They said, Mama, you going again? No way, I'm scared. You die, who watch you, Mama? Who take care of us? And I look my daughter's face. Believe me, trust me, I am come back. I know them, I'm experienced, Mama, learning many, many years. You can touch your computers and laptops, your phone. You had not very comfortable, you no miss it. I'm a look like that mountain. I'm very comfortable. I come back. You know, she look in my face and she say, yes. Promise? Yes, I promise. I come back. You know, of course, I come back again and again. They trust me. You come back me life. Yes.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. My guest today is Lakpa Sherpa, who lives in West Hartford with her children. This past spring, she completed her 9th successful climb of Mount Everest, the world's highest mountain. She's the only woman to hold that record. I asked her how New England's mountains compare to the Himalayas. Sherpa just recently hiked up the White Mountains.
I just summit Mount Washington's 1 month ago. After I coming, I really want to go explore myself, you know. Here in Connecticut, is no had mountains, you know. But here, Connecticut, very near, it's one beautiful mountains that can hike 4 hours. Up 4 hours, come 9 hours, we walk. It's great, you know. Look like it's beautiful round here mountain. And I don't need to go California, Colorado. I opened also Kalowski, Kalaming. You know, I like take who want to go hike with me. I like helping, you know, teach my experience.
You mentioned Cloudscape Climbing. So that's your own company where you take people on hiking and climbing expeditions?
Yes, I like taking hiking and climbing because people want to go, can contact us.
So your day job is you work at Whole Foods as a dishwasher, as you mentioned, but your passion is climbing. That's why you opened up this company?
Yes, yes.
We'll have more information about Cloudscape Climbing on our website at WMPR.org/where we live. Now, Lakhbat, can I ask you about how Mount Everest has become increasingly popular among tourists who want to climb? Are there any concerns that you have with how, I guess, this industry, for lack of a better word, has exploded in recent years? Because it is dangerous. And we know in 2014 there was that avalanche that killed many Sherpas.
Yes. At this Mount Everest, very good popular because everybody want, who don't want to go, you know, top of the wall, you know, beautiful view and beautiful hike. Everybody likes to go, you know. People sometimes scared, but some people not scared. They say, okay, I want to go. It's a beautiful top of the wall. Why not? You know, Sherpa helping. You know, we are helping very well in tourist people that we really, really, some tourists is the problem. We stay there. Some rescue people call. We still stay with the tourist man. Never not let alone. We watching look like a babysitting. You know, bring very well down. And we put them summit. You know, we bring people happy, go send home. We jobs this, you know, makes people happy.
I understand it's not cheap to climb Mount Everest. I think a group of seven, it costs about $70,000. So definitely a certain population of wealthy people can afford to do this. Are there enough, what I'm asking is with the pressure, with the popularity of climbing Mount Everest, are there enough safety measures to protect Sherpas like yourself?
Yes. They're very smart people come in Everest, climbing. They're very rich people. And also the very educated people comes. They want to do only one time, and they go home, and it's good. Mm-hmm. They want to dream successfully, happy, what they want.
I mentioned earlier that earlier this year, you climbed Mount Everest for the 9th time successfully. When's the next time that you'll be attempting this? Because you said to us that, you know, it's almost as if the mountain calls you back time and time again. And how long does it take? How much time out of the year does it take to climb Mount Everest?
2 months. The Everest is a season. One season coming, one time, 1 year, so one season comes. This season is April and May. After it, they had a very good season because spring's very near, you know, we follow the spring up in this. One season's the best area, the April. And I go fly April 10 in Kathmandu, and after I start them climbing up in the mountains. In May 2021, I summit all the times, maybe early. Defend the Everest weather.
Lakhbat Sherpa again is a West Hartford resident. She's climbed Mount Everest 9 times, the only woman to do so. She holds the record, and she'll be summiting Mount Everest again next spring. Lakhbat, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much and invite me talking radio. I'm so happy. Namaste, my side. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Carmen Baskoff. Check out WMPR.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.